Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg warned the U.S. Congress Wednesday of a threat of a more assertive Russia, saying that the West's key military alliance is not looking to start a new Cold War with Moscow, but needs to deter its military aggression. In an unprecedented address to a joint session of Congress on the 70th anniversary of NATO's creation at the end of World War II, Stoltenberg said the 29th nation North or 29-nation North Atlantic Treaty Organization has no intention of deploying land-based nuclear missiles in Europe. He also accused Russia of violating the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, which the U.S. says it is leaving because of Russian violations, a claim Russia has denied. A House committee chairman asked the IRS for 6 years of President Trump's tax returns. AP correspondent Mike Rossia.
Representative Richard Neal of Massachusetts, the Democratic chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, has formally asked the IRS to provide 6 years of President Donald Trump's personal and business tax returns. It's the first such request for a sitting president's tax information in 45 years. At the White House, the president shrugged it off.
Until such time as I'm not under audit, I would not be inclined to do that.
Since the 2016 presidential campaign, Trump has repeatedly claimed he's under audit and therefore can't provide his tax information. Mike Gracia, Washington.
A White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow said Wednesday that U.S. trade talks with China are continuing to progress as negotiations between the world's two biggest economies resume in Washington this week. Kudlow told reporters that the two countries made good headway in Beijing last week, with China acknowledging such problematic issues as the theft of intellectual property, forced technology transfers, and computer hacking. More at VOAnews.com. This is VOA News. The U.S. Senate has drafted a plan aimed at helping bring back democracy to Venezuela through economic aid and pushing U.S. allies to impose sanctions on the Maduro regime. 8 Republicans and 7 Democrats are co-sponsors of the Verdad Act. That's the Venezuela Emergency Relief Democracy and Deployment Act. The Democrat Bob Menendez of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee said that the proposal is a bipartisan effort to put teeth behind the support for the Venezuelan people as they seek to restore democracy and prosperity and end the nightmare that has been what's called the Maduro Reign of Terror. The act calls for a peaceful diplomatic solution in Venezuela while authorizing the Trump administration to spend about $400 million in humanitarian aid. Former Vice President Joe Biden is responding to accusations that he violated the personal space of 2 women. He said he will be more mindful about respecting that personal space in the future.
Social norms have begun to change, they've shifted, and the boundaries of protecting personal space have been reset, and I get it.
Lucy Flores, a former Nevada state politician, wrote in New York Magazine last week of how Biden placed his hands on her shoulders, briefly kissed her on the back of the head, and appeared to sniff her hair during a 2014 event. Another woman said Biden grabbed her face during a 2009 gathering in Washington. He has been seen in video standing very close to other women on stages, including with Hillary Clinton. U.S. President Trump signed a memorandum Wednesday to combat the sale of bogus products through online platforms like Amazon and eBay. VOA's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman reports.
Assistant to the President Peter Navarro says Trump has decided it's time to clean up this wild west of counterfeiting and trafficking. The president is directing the Department of Homeland Security to work with other federal agencies to jointly investigate the problem and submit a report with recommendations. Speaking to reporters on a conference call Wednesday, Navarro, who heads the Office of Trade and Manufacturing Policy, estimated up to half of the branded goods online are fake.
VOA Steve Herman reporting. A gift from Japan from more than a century ago is once again creating visitors' frenzy along the Washington Tidal Basin. It is the peak period for the beloved cherry blossoms. The basin is about a 107-acre man-made reservoir on the Potomac River that's home to thousands of cherry blossoms. But experts say that because of rising sea levels and decades of wear and tear, the basin has had chronic flood problems. And now there's a planning for a rehabilitation project that could cost as much as $500 million. That's money that's being planned through donations and government. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, and today is Thursday, April the 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you. A mass vaccination campaign against cholera has begun in Mozambique. The government and other international agencies are trying to prevent the deadly disease from turning into a full-blown epidemic.
The emergency protection is at least 6 months. That's why we'd like to follow up within the 6 months to have a longer protection, because let's not forget the area in Mozambique is highly endemic for cholera anyway.
WHO spokesperson Christian Lindemeyer. We have more on this story, plus a report by Mohammed Yusuf, who is on the ground in the port city of Beira. The town is dealing with the devastation from Cyclone Idai and an outbreak of cholera. In South Africa, leading politicians, including the president, Cyril Ramaphosa, are condemning recent xenophobic attacks directed at foreigners living in the city of Durban.
Groups of criminals who are taking advantage of the economic and social challenges in our townships and then mobilize other criminals to target foreign owned shops.
That is Ndivhuho Mabaya, spokesman for the South African Department of International Relations and Cooperation. We're covering those stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. A mass vaccination campaign against cholera has begun in Mozambique to prevent the deadly disease from turning into a full-blown epidemic. Mozambique's Ministry of Health confirms that more than 1,400 cases of cholera and two deaths, with most cases in Beira, the city hit hardest by Cyclone Idai. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The campaign is spearheaded by the World Health Organization and United Nations Children's Fund. During the coming 5 days, the two agencies and partners plan to vaccinate nearly 900,000 people in the city of Beira and three surrounding areas. Oral cholera vaccinations usually involve two doses given 7 days apart. But WHO spokesman Christian Lindemeyer says the amount of available vaccine is enough for only one dose for each person.
We are hoping that in the course of the year, when things are a bit calmer, a second dose could be given, which then extends, of course, the protection. Right now, the emergency protection is at least 6 months. That's why we'd like to follow up within the 6 months to have a longer protection, because let's not forget the area in Mozambique is highly endemic for cholera anyway.
Aid agencies note the national vaccination campaign is only one of several approaches being taken to curb the spread of cholera. UNICEF spokesman Christophe Boulirac says of equal importance is the provision of safe drinking water to people throughout the disaster zone.
The fact that together with the government and our partner DFID, we have rehabilitated the water system in Beira for 500,000 people after only 1 week, will now pay off, we think, and will contribute to save thousands of lives in the city, just because it's preventing the further spread of the disease.
Cholera is an acute diarrheal disease that can kill within hours if left untreated. It is mainly caused by the ingestion of contaminated food and water. The young, the frail, and the old are most vulnerable. Children in particular are at great risk. Health officials warn children who contract cholera in the morning could be dead by the evening if they are not immediately treated. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Meanwhile, UN agencies, including UNICEF and the WHO, said that they have set up 500 beds in 7 cholera treatment centers across the affected area. In a statement released today, UNICEF said that it had procured 900,000 doses of the cholera vaccine as it begins a campaign to vaccinate thousands of people in the town of Beira. To get an understanding of what is happening on the ground, I reached Daniel Time, UNICEF's communication officer in Maputo. He tells me that one of the main challenges is to contain the spread of cholera to other parts devastated by Cyclone Idai using all means possible, including fixing the water system in the area.
Our biggest concern is now to treat these people who have cholera, but also to contain the disease through a threefold response.
How equipped is the local healthcare system to deal with the outbreak?
Yeah, this is a disaster of a dimension which the health care system in place obviously cannot shoulder after such a big disaster. Hundreds of health centers have been destroyed. And so now we need to work together with the national government, the World Health Organization, UNICEF, and other partners to respond to the cholera cases and to contain the diseases.
And if you're not able to contain this, how many people would potentially be affected by cholera in that area?
Yeah, there is hundreds of thousands of people affected by the cyclone. Tens of thousands are displaced, and these are the most vulnerable to this kind of disease because it's transferred by bad water. So important to provide safe drinking water now in the displaced camps and in the communities most affected. We had one big success that we re-established, rehabilitated the water supply in the city of Beira of 500,000 people, which was so badly affected. And within 1 week, the water was running in the pipes again. And now this really pays off in this situation because it saved thousands of lives of people who would otherwise certainly be in danger to get cholera.
Do you feel that at this point you've been able to contain the epidemic? Do you have the capacity to be able to contain it?
Yeah, we've seen the first successes in the rehabilitation of the water system, but also now we are quite confident that we can vaccinate 900,000 people in this most affected area within the next 5-6 days.
I guess what I wanted to ask is that are you able to reach the people that are affected given the effects that Cyclone Idai has had on the local infrastructure, whether it's the road systems, the clinics, the communication systems? I can hardly hear you right now because it seems to me like the communication systems have been affected. Are you able to reach these people, all the people that have been affected?
Indeed, the biggest challenges are the access. There are indeed parts which can still not be reached by road, and for that we are sending out teams by boat and also by helicopter to reach these people. The other big challenge is indeed, and you mentioned the bad line we are talking on right now. It's much, much worse in some areas of the disaster zone. And so in terms of communication, telling the population, hey, there is a vaccination campaign coming up, it's very difficult. And so our local partner radio stations, many of them have been destroyed. And we can only work with Radio Mozambique, our partner. But we have trained 1,100 volunteers in the last 2 weeks who will go out and visit each and every community in that disaster zone and tell them about these hygiene measures, tell them about the vaccination. Mm. And there's mobile communication teams which go around by 4x4 and reach out to remote communities too with megaphones on the car, on top of the car. Mm. And so we are quite confident that we can get this vaccination done properly.
Daniel Time is UNICEF's chief communication officer. He spoke to me on phone from Maputo. Known as the heart of Mozambique, the port city of Beira is the country's second largest city with an estimated population of 500,000 people. VOA's Mohamed Yusuf is in Beira where he reports on the ongoing efforts by the government of Mozambique, working with aid agencies to bring help to the affected areas.
40-year-old Marcelo Sangolane is one of the hundreds of Mozambicans who lined up Wednesday to get a cholera vaccination in the port city of Beira. He says what he knows about cholera is that it is a deadly disease. If it spreads, it kills many people. I have to be here in line to prevent myself from getting cholera, says Sangolane. Mozambican officials and relief agencies launched a seven-day campaign in four districts in the country's center to combat the spread of cholera. The bacterial disease broke out after the cyclone's heavy winds and rains flooded sewers, spreading dirty water. Cyclone survivor Aida Francisco is leaving nothing to chance. She says she's in line because she fears the disease called cholera, because it is a disease that kills within 24 hours. That is why she is here to get the vaccination, says Francisco. Lucia Luis Francisco, a displaced mother in her 50s, was also lined up for one of 900,000 cholera vaccine doses sent to Mozambique. She says she wants to be clean and healthy because of cholera kills people. The government, with the help of medical aid agencies, has also set up centers to treat and isolate those infected. Maria Matsin is Mozambique's deputy health director.
We will stop the ongoing of outbreak and we will save lives. We will save people be sick, and we believe that if they don't become sick, they will have good health, you know. Yeah, so it will help them on that, and they will be able to continue to doing their reconstruction, you know, that they lose houses, they lose many things.
Cholera causes severe diarrhea, which can lead to dehydration and death if left untreated. For survivors of Cyclone Idai, it is yet another challenge to face before relief can turn to recovery.
This is Daybreak Africa. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. In South Africa, leading politicians, including the President Cyril Ramaphosa, are condemning recent xenophobic attacks. The attacks are directed at foreigners living in the city of Durban. Many Africans living in Durban, the third most populous city in South Africa, have been forced to seek shelter in community halls and police stations. Anita Paul has more on this story.
The recent spate of violent, deadly attacks against impoverished foreign nationals isn't about outsiders, South Africans say, but rather about the country's problems and contentious politics. Last week, a mob in the coastal city of Durban attacked a group of largely undocumented Malawians, killing at least two people. Low-level xenophobic violence is a continuous reality in South Africa, peaking in 2008 in a spate of attacks that left 67 people dead. With its developed economy, South Africa has long been a magnet for intra-African migration. Difuho Mabaya, spokesman for the South African Department of International Relations and Cooperation, told VOA that police came up with a simple analysis of the situation during a meeting earlier this week with top South African officials and the diplomatic corps.
These are groups of criminals who are taking advantage of the economic and social challenges in our townships and then mobilize other criminals to target foreign-owned shops. So what we have agreed is that the police will go back, do more work on the investigations, come back on Friday to present again to the ambassador.
Those who work with foreign nationals say this isn't a simple matter of crime and punishment. Sharona Kambram, who leads the Refugee and Migrant Rights Program for Lawyers for Human Rights, reiterated her group's explanations for the causes of this violence. Abject poverty, inequality, and the government's failure to improve living standards for all South Africans. Ikambram, however, said she is encouraged by the International Relations Department's response this time, although she urged the government to do more.
I feel like structures like disaster management response, in general, the state at all levels, the response in proportion to what's taking place remains inadequate. And we go back to this every time this happens. We're in this state, media is covering it, and we can't see a visible presence of the police. We can't see anyone being arrested for unlawful behavior. And we're all running around trying to see what we could do.
This episode of violence has come before a major election, which appears to have prompted a flurry of high-level condemnations, including from President Cyril Ramaphosa. But only days earlier, on the campaign trail, he had harshly criticized small business owners, many of whom are foreign nationals, who set up shop in impoverished areas without obtaining the proper licenses. And so both activists like Ikambram and political players like the small far-left Black First Land First movement, which also condemned the attacks, say political parties bear responsibility for the attacks as well. This is BLF Deputy President Zanele Luana.
So it is them, the African National Congress, and parties such as the Democratic Alliance, who fuel this kind of thinking that puts our people in a position where they have to attack other black people.
The long-ruling ANC is expected to dominate the May elections. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. For more stories and extended reports on what is happening around the African continent, don't forget to check us out on our website at www.voanews.com. And from South Africa, we go to Cameroon, the home of the Jah Fauna Reserve, one of the largest and best protected rainforests in Africa, with 90% of its area left untouched. The reserve is known for its biodiversity and a wide variety of primates. And in 1987, UNESCO designated parts of the forest as a World Heritage Site. However, environmentalists are now worried that that is about to change. See, 4 years ago, work began on a new highway close to the forest. And now that that highway is about to be completed, conservationists are worried that devastation is coming to one of Africa's most untouched rainforests. Eugene Fongo reports from Jom in Cameroon.
Deputy jungle work crews move tons of earth, using the crushing force of bulldozers to level chunks of hillsides, fill up valleys, and bring down acres of dense woodlands. It is mid-February, the air is moist and hot, and a new highway is taking shape. Soon, Cameroon and the Republic of Congo will be linked by road for the first time. In many ways, this is good news. The Road of Hope, as some call it, will bring services to dozens of far-flung forest communities. It will boost trade between Cameroon and Congo, and hopefully, it will drive down poverty. But conservation workers warn that nature is paying a huge price. The route passes just south of the famous Jah Reserve, through some of Africa's best-kept rainforest landscapes, which sprawl into Gabon and Congo. Jirel Hallison is the policy coordinator for business and industries at WWF Cameroon. He says planned infrastructure will degrade the integrity of the forest.
We might not have it becoming an undisturbed area where wildlife could still live peacefully. We have humans getting increasingly in contact with this wildlife.
A low human footprint has been key to keeping the forest here intact. Small towns and villages are miles apart, and industrial interests have stayed away because of the dense woods and rugged terrain. With the ease of travel in sight, dam building, mining, exploration and large-scale agriculture are already in the pipeline. Logging, the leading economic activity, is set to expand. Hallison says wildlife will not feel at home in the emerging landscape.
When we put things like dams and other projects, and so we can still get the same composition of nature like it was. Wildlife that is used to a more intact forest doesn't find itself very much comfortable in integrated forests. And the wildlife will have to move to other areas where they could find refuge, could be far from human contact. And if they can't, because of the increasing installation of new projects, economic projects, then you have a high possibility of human-wildlife conflict.
More than 25,000 elephants, 40,000 great apes, and hundreds of endangered species could be affected by the road and other projects. Already, conservation workers say poaching and cross-border wildlife trafficking is rising. Despite the threat, hopes to preserve the character of the forest have not faded, but the big questions have shifted. Jill Zetoga runs projects across the landscape for WWF. He says stakeholders must figure out how to balance development and conservation.
We know that we cannot put a protected area everywhere. This is 5 million hectares. Well, you cannot have protected area for 5 million hectares. So, first of all, we need to acknowledge the other sectorial needs.
The Ministry of Economy is leading a land use planning initiative. Etoga says one goal is to accommodate competing interests such as conservation, road building, mining, and agribusiness, and give each a slice of the forest.
The first success is that we have 5 protected areas, and those protected areas are no-go zone for other sectorial. Everybody have it in their mind that you cannot have mining inside the JAR reserve, you cannot have logging concession inside dark green that we have here. You cannot have other activities than conservation inside those areas. The second success would be that in places out of protected areas, we need to negotiate the type of activities or how are they going to implement their activities.
Forest communities are caught between these powerful interests. They complain that both conservation and infrastructure are taking away their land rights. With little voice, they are very likely to be hurt as badly as the wildlife with which they have lived in harmony for centuries. Eugene Fongwa for VOA in Jum, Cameroon.
Kenyan doctors working in Cuba will be getting a pay raise. And this is after the Kenyan Medical Practitioners and Dentists Union threatened to go to court for the termination of Kenyan doctors' contract in Cuba following the death of Dr. Hamisi Aljuma, who allegedly committed suicide, citing hardship in a foreign state. For more on this story, Moreno Jambo reports from Nairobi, Kenya.
Families of Kenyan doctors working in Cuba under an exchange program between Kenya and Cuba came to the limelight after the death of Dr. Hamisi Aljuma, who is alleged to have committed suicide following hardship in Cuba, urging the government to withdraw their kids from Cuba who had complained of poor working conditions. The doctors are said to have complained of high cost of living in Cuba and that the monthly remuneration was insufficient to cater for their needs and the families back home. Kenya's Health Cabinet Secretary Cecil Kariuki yesterday, Wednesday, said that the decision to have the doctor's salary increased was made after a team sent by the ministry to Cuba found out that the cost of living in Cuba was relatively expensive.
We have adjusted the allowances for them to be able to seek alternative accommodation. So the issue of the students really coming back on account of overplaying the matter, as far as the ministry leadership goes or government, stops there. It's been addressed. We will be vigilant to monitor if there are any emerging issues, and the embassy in Havana has undertaken Project Cuba coordinating team here, which is being headed by the Director of Medical Services right here, will be on a periodic basis again be checking on what is happening.
The death incident caused an outrage among Kenyan doctors, whom some cited frustrations and depression to tough living conditions that might have caused the death of Dr. Hamisi Juma. Kariuki, however, said that the Kenyan embassy in Cuba and Cuba's health ministry will ensure the doctor's welfare is well catered for.
In the coming months, the Cuban government will be sending a team of research scientists to Kenya to develop joint projects with the Kenyan counterparts from Cambry. Initial discussions on this matter will allow for us to take on the novel diabetic food therapy, and vaccine development and production of the same have already commenced. Again, on their part, the Vice President committed to fast track and ensure that the scientists who we will be bringing into Kenya are put on a fast track in terms of identification.
The doctors' union still hold that the doctors have constantly expressed their frustrations with the manner in which the government has withheld or completely failed to pay their living expenses in a foreign country. The union secretary general, Ouma Oluga, further complained that their Cuban counterparts received the royal treatment in Kenya as compared to Kenyan doctors in Cuba. The Kenyan doctors in Cuba are now hopeful that their state of living will change since the increased allowances were announced a day after President Uhuru Kenyatta held talks with Maria Chapman, the vice president of Cuban Council of State and Ministries. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Moreno Jembo in Nairobi, Kenya.
And that's it for this Thursday, April the 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. Thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good morning, Africa.